place, I'd like to share these recordings with you.
Hey, Marmac family. Welcome back to the Maintainer Podcast, the show where we shine a spotlight on the people and stories driving fleet readiness at the Mid-Atlantic Regional Maintenance Center. I'm Jared Patch with the Marmac Public Affairs Office, and today's episode, it's another heavy hitter. From the high-torque mechanics of a diesel clutch overhaul to the cutting-edge promise of 3D printing, we've got another lineup of conversations that showcase how innovation, teamwork, and attention to detail keep our mission moving forward. We'll hear from Marmac CEO Captain Heminger, talk about the importance of OPSEC, and wade into the world of welding. So stay tuned and turn it up. You're listening to the Maintainer Podcast. Let's get into it. To kick things off, we'll check in with our commanding officer, Captain Dan Heminger, for a roundup of recent command wins around the waterfront. Over to you, Captain.
Hello, Marmac family. It's your commanding officer, Captain Heminger. I wanted to highlight some of the amazing work we have accomplished throughout July. First, the USS Bataan completed current docking from the dry dock at NASSCO shipyard on the 3rd of July. This was 2 weeks early and an amazing accomplishment from the team at Marmac. Additionally, USS Porter, only a couple weeks later, successfully dry docked at the same shipyard over at NASSCO, and we're excited for that team as they're well on their way to finishing that avail on time. As we know, ship repair is not confined to the work week, and we often answer the call on weekends or on holidays. That's exactly what happened on the 4th of July holiday weekend on the USS Billings. Within hours of suffering a puncture to that hull, Marmac was involved in crafting a suitable temporary repair option. This was a total team effort as the command worked together to fabricate and send a team of heavy hitters out the door to respond to the casualty, since Billings was located in Rhode Island at the time. That warship eventually returned to sea with zero loss to VO, and that was a direct result of the dedication of the Marmac team. Well done. We reached 72 days without a drug incident and another consecutive 72 days without a DUI, which means on August 1st and August 15th, military personnel receive 72 hours special liberty and civilians receive 59 minutes early dismissal. You've earned it. Remember to make smart decisions and stay safe. Let's aim for another consecutive 72 for 72. Over at Dynamic, the Navy's oldest floating dry dock, they successfully completed a docking and undocking evolution for LCU 1654, assigned to a soft craft unit 2. BZ to the CO, Lieutenant Commander Jeremy Mainfield, and the amazing Dynamic team. Dynamic's mission underscores the ongoing strategic value of afloat maintenance capabilities and the ability of Navy assets like Dynamic to deliver flexible, cost-effective support in direct alignment with fleet readiness objectives. Be sure to check out the next episode of the podcast to hear from Lieutenant Commander Mayfield himself and a few of his sailors involved with that evolution. Special shout out to Gas Turbine Systems technicians First Class Ha and Second Class Garcia for their work in Poland during their flyaway team visit. The Polish Navy, a strategic ally, was in a situation where they were in desperate need of significant engine replacement on two of their frigates, formerly known as the USS Clark, FFG 11, and USS Wadsworth, FFG 9. BZ to the whole flyaway team, and thank you for your immense wealth of knowledge in aiding our allies. GSM 1 Ha and GSM 2 Garcia will also be on the next podcast episode, so tune in and learn more about the flyaway team's efforts in Poland. In closing, I am so proud of everything we have accomplished these last couple of months. Bravo Zulu to each and every one of you. I take great pride in being your commanding officer. Keep doing what we do best, and that is generating the critical readiness that's consumed 24/7, 365 by our operational fleets. This is Captain Heminger signing out.
Next up, a Marmac first. Our iLevel production shops recently completed their first ever overhaul of a 2-alpha main propulsion diesel engine clutch assembly, a major milestone made possible by tight collaboration between our production and engineering teams. Public affairs specialist Oscar Pope sat down with CW03 Waller to get the full story, what the job involved, why it's such a challenge, and how the team brought it together.
Marmac as a whole, I love ship repair, you know. So when we do come to the RMCs as you know, journeyman apprenticeships and learning the technical side of it, our guys jump all over it. So this is a job that we've never done before. We take it head on.
Whether you're a gearhead or just curious what it takes to overhaul an engine the size of a small car, this segment's for you.
Hey, today I'm here with CWO3 Maurice Waller, branch head of Code 930 and subject matter expert. Warrant Officer Waller spearheaded the oversight of the 2 Alpha main propulsion diesel engine clutch assembly repair and overhaul aboard the USS Mesa Verde. This is why we're here today, to talk about that assembly and a repair. Mr. Waller, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you having me here.
Yeah, it's absolutely a pleasure to speak with you on this topic. Tell us a little bit about your military background.
So I was prior enlisted. I enlisted in 1998. It'll be 27 years next month. Came in as a GSM. Did 20 years as enlisted all the way up to senior chief. Then got commissioned as a warrant officer. And then been stationed San Diego, Norfolk, now here in Merrimack as a warrant officer.
When I say subject matter expert, is it safe to say you're a subject matter expert on engines?
Yeah, I would think so. I have some diesel experience and obviously gas turbine experience. I used to be a gas turbine inspector before I commissioned. Obviously, once you commission, you lose your certification. But I could always go that route, you know, once I transition over at some point.
My military career, you got a chief warrant officer. You better believe they're the expert in that field. So I'm talking to the right guy.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. Yes, sir. Yeah, so we'll get right into it. We'll talk about this 2 Alpha main propulsion diesel engine clutch assembly repair and overhaul. Is that what happened with it?
Pretty much, yes, sir. So the clutch assembly is the medium between the prime mover and the shaft. So the clutch, obviously, kind of like a car, engages and drives the shaft to make the ships move. A little while ago, that clutch caught fire. And it required, obviously, depot-level, IMA-level repairs to the clutch itself. Not necessarily a ship force-capable job, just due to the severity of the job, the requirements and the technical requirements to get that completely overhauled.
So can you talk to me a little bit about that evolution? So we never like to hear the word fire on a ship, on a Navy vessel, first and foremost.
Yes.
But the clutch assembly, and that was my first experience with any type of clutch, was my first vehicle.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit more about how that clutch actually works in relation to the engine and propulsion.
Okay, so the clutch is actually the transition between the high speed, well, the speed of the diesel. The diesel is the prime mover that's, you know, obviously providing power.
Right.
We need to get that power, that horsepower that the diesel is producing to ultimately move the ship. So the clutch is very integral in moving the ship. The clutch engages on pneumatic air pressure and centrifugal force. It's engaging on a mechanical level and pneumatic level to lock in place to get that shaft to rotate and move forward.
That's a lot of mechanics involved to somebody who is definitely non-mechanical. Mm-hmm. So I can understand that it's a device that allows the transition from one gear to the next, allowing power to the shafts and propellers to get the ship moving forward.
Essentially, yes.
Is that about right?
That's about right.
I'm just a little bit smarter now.
Oh, nice, nice. Ideally, you know, you could actually operate that diesel without rotating the shaft if you were in port, had to do any type of inspections, evolutions, or prior to getting underway, we would have to start that diesel. Obviously, you don't want it to clutch in automatically. So that clutch allows us a little bit of opportunity, a little bit of time to get everything ready to go before we're able to actually cast the lines over and get underway and have the shaft operational. So
right. Mm-hmm. Still a little too technical for my blood, but I'm pretty sure we have some EMs and MMs out there like, oh, yeah, that's totally right. totally. He's spot on. But look, let's jump right into it. Mm-hmm. So walk us through what happened aboard Mesa Verde. I know they were coming off deployment the year prior. They're in MHI right now.
Yes.
Tell us what happened.
I don't have all the detail, obviously, since it happened several years ago. I got here last year, coming into that situation, knowing that we had this repair that we had to take on. But ultimately, what I understand is there was a fire, there was damage that was caused to the clutch that prevented it from operation. So because of that clutch was out of operation, that whole engine was not operational. So obviously, we want redundancy with anything military related. We didn't have that redundancy.
Is it safe to say for these many years that the ship was still on the way, the clutch assembly needed repair? We're just finally getting to that repair?
Correct. It's normally a depot level repair where it requires OEM to do the repair. So the logistics behind getting all the technical documentations and having eye-level production, diesel code and tech code from code 200, all on board, getting everything situated, along with all the parts that was required to replace this clutch, takes time. So yes, yeah, it seems like a long process, but this is a very unorthodox repair. It's not like replacing a valve or something that we do on a routine basis. These clutches typically don't go out or, you know, stick with the friction and cause the fire like they normally do. You know, we have systems in place, PMS and so on and so forth, to check for any type of unusual wear and so on and so forth. Anything mechanical, you know, there's an anomaly. Yeah, so that's what that was. So because this was a very unorthodox process, our diesel shop is relatively new. We just stood up our diesel shop a couple of years ago. And, you know, not having experience like we do with turbines and change out engines at least 12 to 18 times a year, gas turbine engines, we had to walk this down, you know, and make sure we had the parts, tools, and materials.
So the ship is essentially 18 years old. Does the age of the ship have anything to do with the duration at which a clutch can last?
Yes, most definitely. But however, you know, there's a cycle for wearable materials like a clutch. So don't quote me. I'm not sure for this style of clutch, but I would assume like every 5 years, you know, the pads would have to be replaced, the clutch pads or the liner or so on and so forth. So, yes, that clutch wouldn't last for the whole duration of the 18 years, the internal parts. However, the housing and the liner and everything else should, majority of the clutch should be able to withstand that life cycle of the ship.
So you inherited this issue as the branch head.
Yes, sir.
The repair is underway.
Yes, sir.
What makes this particular clutch assembly repair a little bit unusual?
The Mesa Verde is in the availability right now, maintenance CNO availability. So they have a lot of other maintenance items, repairs that's getting done. So deconflicting the repairs from the contractors, MHI, on top of the repairs that we're doing, that's a challenge. Another thing that makes this repair a little, you know, challenging is the location of it. It's all the way at the bottom of the ship inside the main space. So getting that clutch from the pier down to the space, deconflicting with other repairs that's going on, that made it a little bit challenging. And then three, the OEM aspect of the repair. There is a portion where we do need OEM representation to, you know, provide any type of inputs at a certain point of this repair to solidify the actual clutch replacement. Those were what are the challenging parts. And on top of that, parts. Parts was a huge, I don't want to say hindrance, but a huge hurdle that we had to get over to locate the certain parts, amount of parts, long lead time materials. Some were a 20 to 30 week lead time. So it obviously, you know how that goes, and nobody wants to hear that, but we are kind of limited to our logistics.
Yeah, I was definitely about to mention, how much of that material was long lead time?
Quite a bit. To be honest with you, we got lucky. We found a battle spare clutch through our maintenance team, through the production team, through the tech code. You know, Marmac kind of came together. Otherwise, we would still be waiting for long lead time material right now. But we found a battle spare on top of all the parts that we received thus far. And we were able to actually get the old one out and get the new one in. And now we're kind of waiting for, you know, to schedule an OEM to finish off that job and mirror up with the ship on when they're ready to light off and op test. So because they're still in the CNO, even if we had OEM tomorrow, they wouldn't be ready to op test until they're ready to PCD, production completion date, and ready to light off flammables, liquids and fuel and stuff like that.
So a bit of ways to go.
Yes, sir.
You know, you definitely have a talented team of engine men. So
yes, sir.
How do you manage those guys?
They manage themselves. No, I just provide oversight. I pride myself at, you know, with the engine shop. You know, I don't know, I'm being biased. Marmac as a whole, I love ship repair, you know. But the, you know, the diesel shop being a prior, you know, GS, being on a prior diesel ship, you know, gas turbine shop, those are my two shops. They take pride in repairing engines. We don't have the opportunity to do that at sea due to our obligations. So when we do come to the RMCs as, you know, journeyman apprenticeships and learning the technical side of it, our guys jump all over it. So this is a job that we've never done before. We take it head on. The majority of that work was done by Chris, our diesel shop supervisor, civilian. He with our guys, our engine men, you know, Sims and MJ and everybody, grabbed the bull by the horns and went forward with it. Reaching out, coordinating with Tech Code. On my level, I do a little bit of it, but it's also trying to network and get everybody together on one page. So that's ShipForce, that's Tech Code, that's our production shop. That's, you know, everybody's trying to come together to accomplish this huge, momentous job that's never been done before from a diesel shop in Merrimack.
Right, yeah. That's a huge accomplishment, having homegrown talent get the job done in-house. Yes. We can call it in-house.
Yes.
Moving forward, how confident are you that, you know, Code 900's homegrown talent to do future repairs and overhauls of this magnitude? How confident are you?
I'm 100% confident. To include, now that we have the experience, our continuity with our civilian representation of diesel shoppers there, not to mention we also had rig shop and welding shop support for rigging and also removing temporary services. So that was another piece that we did, Merrimack, as an eye level that wasn't really anticipated, but we took it on. So now us having that ability opens up a lot more opportunity, not, you know, cheaper, you know, as opposed to a depot level. And it gets our guys that experience. So when they go back out to sea, they can understand it. Oh, wait a minute. All right. This is a problem. This clutch doesn't sound right. That type of situation where they can identify when they go back out to sea and eventually transition out to the civilian world.
Yeah, 100%. OJT.
Yes, sir.
OJT.
OJT.
That's how I've always understood the best way to learn. Get in there and get it done. Learn along the way. So thanks for spearheading that, leading these guys. We hear you doing great things. More to follow on the clutch assembly repair with your guys. If there's one final thought you can leave with either the crew or future engine men, what is that final thought?
The final thought is, if it's broke, let's fix it. You know, let's find a way to fix it. If it's unorthodox or if it's something that we haven't done before, we don't necessarily stop. We're going to continue or try to identify the situation or identify a yes or a correction. So keep pushing, keep trucking, and continue to learn on the mechanical, technical side as well.
Warrant Officer Waller, thanks for your time.
Yes, sir. All right, thank you very much.
Oscar also caught up with the team behind the overhaul to hear how it all unfolded, straight from the source. Members of the Code 931 Diesel Shop,
Chris Caleb,
EN2MJ,
EN2 Gurchin,
EN2 Sims,
Al, you read me?
I'm good.
All right, you were good.
Visited the studio to continue the conversation.
We're here with the Code 931 Diesel Shop. I got with me here Chris Callow, EN2 Gurchin, EN2 Mayanja, and EN2 Sims. Guys, thanks for joining us on the show today.
No problem.
Yep. Chris, we want to start with you. Where are you from?
Suffolk, Virginia.
Oh, Suffolk, right down the street.
Yes, sir.
Not too far from the base. Gurchin, where are you from?
I'm from Nice, California.
Nice?
Mm-hmm.
It looks like nice,
mm-hmm.
But pronounced niece.
Yeah, it's a pronunciation of it. It got me my whole life, too.
I bet. In Mayanja, where are you from?
Born and raised in Kampala, Uganda. Moved into the U.S. in 2017, living with my parents in Massachusetts, Boston, and that's where I enlisted from.
Sims, where are you from?
I'm from Lippi Fields, Illinois, a small town outside of Chicago, south suburbs.
Nice. Guys, once again, thanks for being here. We want to highlight this evolution, the 2-alpha main propulsion diesel engine repair installment overhaul. Is that what we're calling it?
It's an overhaul of the 2-alpha MPDE clutch.
Nice. Chris, you're the supervisor of this amazing group. Tell us how we got here.
Well, start off expanding Merrimack's capabilities, and we worked with Code 264 and decided that we are capable of accomplishing this. And it's still an ongoing project, but so far, everybody's done an outstanding job. Especially the sailors here in our diesel shop, along with their civilian counterparts.
Right. So when are we expecting this evolution to conclude?
We haven't came on to that date yet.
So no date right now. But so the evolution is still in progress. Lots of materials that still need to be ordered. So this is an evolution that is definitely ongoing. The entire command is rooting for your success, as am I. Tell us, we'll start with you, Gurchin. What are you learning on this evolution?
I'm learning a lot about the actual clutch setup. And the differences in how it sets up to more of like civilian life applications. I'm learning a lot with a different style of tools that we're using on the job. Instead of using a normal torque wrench, we have to use it with a torque multiplier, or I use it for the first time, but a torque gun, which was very, very handy. learning a lot about how the rig shop does their thing with pulling these very heavy and very large parts out from the space as well.
Those are definitely important aspects of learning on the job training, being here at Marmac. Mm-hmm. And it takes me to Mayanja. You also have some contribution here on this solution. So tell me what you've learned.
Mine is more of pretty much learning how the actual clutch is intertwined with how it works with the engine, different components, different style of engines that I've worked on, but pretty much just learning more, getting, you know, familiar with the actual, you know, the equipment. Been a great success so far. So hopefully to learn more.
Yeah, definitely can appreciate your learning experience as it relates to our readiness here at Marmac and building homegrown sailors to do the job for us. Absolutely love it. And finally, it takes us to, we're here now with Ian Two Sims. You're the only one that's qualified NAMPS.
Yes, sir.
So that makes you the lead of Gershon and Sims.
I'm not the lead, but I want to say it's a team effort.
Yeah, like, absolutely.
I'm learning on the go as well. Like this clutch job that we just did, it's like our first one in a diesel shop. So we normally like work on like the diesel engines itself. So this was kind of a first like task we have to do, but in all fairness, I think it went good. So,
yeah, tell us how NAMPS has allowed you to do the work that you're doing.
Oh, so NAMPS is a real good tool to use. It's pretty much a study guide of like an in-rate study guide of what you should be doing on an everyday basis. So like some of the stuff that you learn in NAMPS, you do it like on these jobs. So like it talks about like fuel injection repair. If you like read the NAMPS booklet, it tells you like step by steps on how to do it and like on the ship and like in a real life situation. So I really like the NAMPS program and it helps out a lot.
Yep. We want to definitely highlight how NAMPS is important, especially overall to the naval readiness. Gershon, how far are you on your NAMPS qualification?
I'm a little over halfway.
A little halfway? We'll get there this year?
Oh, yeah.
100%. I love it. What about you, Mayanja?
I would say about 80%. So it should be done within the next couple months.
80%. So definitely, yeah. We're looking forward to having even two more qualified NAMPS NECs given to Gershon and Mayanja, which even bolsters more naval readiness here at Marmac. Chris, you got any final words?
A lot of moving parts in this job, a lot of different shops, and everybody's just been one of the smoothest evolutions I've been a part of since I've been at Marmac. I mean, everybody's done great. Everybody showed up. I mean, took lead, jumped in where they need to jump in at, and I'm happy with the way it's gone so far.
How is it working with these guys?
It's entertaining. Very much so.
Absolutely. Hey, any final shout outs from anybody here? Who do you want to shout out?
I'd have to say the rig shop. They did a great job with ensuring they had plenty of parts, tools to get all this very heavy and large equipment out from the space and maneuvering it around all the other components in the engine room. I'd say they did a great job as well.
What about you, Mayanja? Who you want to shout out?
Can we do parents?
Yeah.
Okay. First and foremost, I would give a shout out to the, like you said, the rig shop. They did a great job with all the heavy parts lifting. And then I also give a shout out to my parents back in Boston, Reading. You know, they've got me where they've got me.
Sims?
Yeah, I want to give two shout outs. Also, with the rig shop, the HT shop, they played a factor in some of the job too. And also, I want to shout out my own wife and kids too. So
yeah, 100%.
Got to throw them out too. So yeah, with the rig shop, the HT shop, they help cut stuff up so we can like take out the clutch.
That's it for today's podcast, man. The 2-Alpha main propulsion diesel engine repair overhaul underway, still ongoing. Code 931 at the helm, driving this thing home. Let them cook. For all the seasoned workforce, let them cook means let them continue to do what they're good at, and we'll have faith that you guys will succeed.
Absolutely.
The work on USS Mesa Verde is still underway, but the coordination between shops and departments has already made this effort a textbook example of cross-functional success. It's a reminder that when we rally around a shared goal, Marmac can take on just about anything. Let's shift gears. Summer is in full swing, and it's hot out there. As if 95-degree heat and 90% humidity weren't enough, sailors in the shipfitter shop take on high-stakes, high-temperature work every day, all to get ships back to the fleet. Public affairs specialist Harrison Cox spoke with HTFN Wiles to learn more about the craft of welding, the materials, the methods, the safety precautions, and why welding with wet gloves is never a good idea.
If you want to get into welding, make sure you have dry gloves.
Dry gloves, okay. Yeah.
And now, over to Harrison.
Hello, everyone. My name is Harrison Cox, and I am sitting here with someone from Code 921, our shipfitter code. Sir, if you want to introduce yourself, please.
Yeah, I'm HDFN Wiles. Been at Marmec for about a little over a year, hitting 2 years soon. Work over in shipfitter shop, the actual shipfitter shop, because within that we have three different subdivisions of that code.
Okay, very nice. And I remember you talking to me right before we started recording. You joined the Navy right out of high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what is your hometown?
I'm from Ranch Cucamonga, California.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
So basically San Bernardino County, which is about an hour and a half, 2 hours north of San Diego.
And is it safe to assume that you like the weather here, like the weather we had earlier this week?
Rain is definitely a change.
Yeah.
Humidity is something I got to get used to.
Oh, for sure. So you're a welder here, right?
Yes.
Okay. And if you could just explain to us what welding is in simple terms for people that may not know.
Layman's terms?
Yeah.
You're gluing metal with metal.
Okay.
Using electricity. There's a lot of components with it. Like there's different materials we got to use. So we got stainless steel, carbon steel, copper, nickel. Sometimes people get away with using the non-ferrous metals for brazing. They'll just weld them out. And then also we use aluminum a lot of time. And so then we do a lot of electricity. So we have like direct currents, alternating currents, and a bunch of different shielding gases that we use with it to help make sure the metal fuses properly and just bonds correctly.
It sounds very in-depth and way above my head, to be honest. And I know that there's different kinds of welding. Like I know that there is a thing called TIG welding. Do you guys do any of that? Like what's like the different kinds of welding?
So at Marmec, we have the main two processes, TIG and STICK. So their proper names is GTAW, gas tungsten arc welding, and then SMAW, which is the shielded metal arc welding. With the TIG, the gas tungsten, it's a little torch that has a hose connected to it that you're connected to gas. We use 100% argon. From there, there's a little porcelain cup on the end of it with a piece of tungsten inside that connects your arc to the base metal and then another filler metal on your opposite hand that you feed into the puddle when you're melting down the base.
What would you say drew you to welding for the Navy?
I did a little soldering work growing up, working on guitars, and I just wanted to take it to a bigger step. Saw a lot of your videos on it. I was like, that looks fun. Let's do it.
Yeah, let's do that. Okay. Talking about welding here, what kind of routine or normal jobs do you see yourself or Nico 921 doing here at Marmec?
So like basic packages, like anyone could touch. We start with a lot of brackets. Recently, we just finished a Seaways bracket. The one that has a lot more eyes on them a lot of time is bulkhead replacements, bulkhead patches, where we'll actually cut out a whole piece of the bulkhead, replace it. That usually are longer jobs. And then J-bar davit holders, the flower pots. So the little equipment we use to get the ribs on and off the ship, or even sometimes up towards by the 5-inch, there's the little elevator, and they have to use these, we call them flower pots, where they put these big, heavy aluminum bars inside of them, and they hoist them up. We got to fabricate from scratch those, and those take about 2 weeks start to finish to do, and that's all in shop. We do a lot of those and a lot of bulkhead replacements.
The most difficult job you've ever had to work on here at Marmec, what would you say that would be?
Probably what we're still working on currently is replacing a deck socket on one of the flight decks. It's becoming a bigger pain, not so much the material, but more of the where we're working at. There's a lot of piping in the way, wires in the way. It's very restricted. And then also with the weather and then also preheating the deck, it's very long, strenuous on that one.
Yeah. Sounds like it. Talking about safety now for welding, I know that, you know, there's a lot of safety protocols. If you could just talk to us a little bit about that. I know that you guys have the welding mask and all that, but you could just talk about safety.
Yeah, no, so of course, there's our welding hoods. They come in all different shapes. They're usually a fiber metal. Just they don't melt as easy compared to like other materials like plastic or rubber. Some people use flash hoods, the FR-resistant flash hoods. Then we have our fitter's caps that we wear underneath. That way you don't get all the oils into the hood. Also keeps your head protected from sparks or anything that's coming at you. Sleeves are a must because even if you're not producing sparks from stick welding or you're doing TIG welding, you will get sunburnt from the UV rays that are coming off of it. So I usually wear my coveralls, roll my sleeves all the way down, and then, of course, your gloves. There's all kinds of different gloves we can use, different amount of insulation in them, dexterity, different leathers. But underneath that, you always got to have your safety glasses and your pro in, just general good rule of thumb.
For sure.
Yeah.
Okay. And are there any unique challenges for welding here at Marmec that you've seen?
In shop-wise, if you haven't touched more than one process of welding, it's learning that new process. The goal here with that a lot of our first classes and chiefs try to push on us is become combination welders, which is the best possible way because then you can't always just do your one preferred process on everything. You got to switch it up. So it's good to learn like for me, I'm a stick welder. That's my favorite process. But there are times where, like aluminum, you cannot use stick at all. Well, you can. Not recommended. It's not in our instruction. So we use TIG. Had to learn pretty quick how to do that and still learning. There's that challenge in shop of learning the process. And then on the ship, it's tight spaces, not a lot of visibility. So sometimes I haven't personally done it. I make someone else do it. That is a little much more skilled than I am of mirror welding, where they just put a mirror on it and they just hope for the best that they're getting the proper fusion.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So how do you deal with that? Like, let's say if the space doesn't have good lighting or something like that.
Some of us, one of my second classes, he has an actual, like the little camping headlamps.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So okay. He'll pop that on if it's too dark. And then luckily with the welding lenses, some of them you can change the settings to your sensitivity where it won't get confused between the headlamp and your arc.
It sounds pretty smart. I mean, if it works, it works. That's good. How do you balance sending quality work to the fleet with the Navy's need to keep ships operational?
Mainly just become proficient and understanding how these processes work, and then also understand the ship's availability, try to do the best we can. Understanding your machine and understanding your process is going to help it go much faster. Like we all say in Whole Branch, the longest part about the job is getting the ship to support and getting set up.
Mm-hmm.
Once we're allowed to strike our arc, it's a lot faster.
And does Code 921 have to work alongside other codes for the most part, or is it mainly just your own
like
code?
We'll give each other on loan to, I believe it's 924 or Pipe Shop when they need extra help. So like I have brace quals. If they truly, truly need me, they'll send me there to go help with that. We'll just share people around if we're low manned. And then within our code, we have our shipfitter shop, then we have like Amphib, Sheet Metal, and then 921 Civilian. I was TAD to 921 Civilian for the past year. So that we bounce around shop to shop to help each other out.
Okay. So going back to you and career aspirations, is there anything that you want to accomplish while you're here at Marmac or maybe the Navy as a whole?
Definitely at the point I'm at right now, I want to go to C school, our U-53 Alpha school for HTs, which is our advanced welding program. One of the hardest C schools there is, super high fail rate. I think it's at like 95% fail.
So it sounds pretty tough.
Yeah. I think I might be inflaming that. I know it's above 80% fail rate though.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what's your experience been like working here at Marmac? And is there anything that you enjoy being on shore duty rather than sea duty?
Work-wise, definitely love learning the welding side and then also the ability of where there are slow seasons where we have quite a few strike groups out at sea. It's a lot of downtime, so we have a lot of spare metal that I can just go grab, start practicing, and just make sure I'm on top of my technique, make sure it's good to go. And then better learning our machines, because that's a big thing is the better you know your machine, better know what to look for in your weld, the better welder you're going to be.
I know that there's slow seasons and I'm sure there's, you know, fast seasons. How do you guys deal with the time constraints? Let's say like, hey, there's a ship that needs to have this certain thing welded. What's that like? Are there time restraints for that?
There can be. There's been a few times where we get CAS reps where they're like, hey, this just came in. We got 48 hours to do it. Go do it. So if we got to come in, there's been days I've come in on Saturdays. Just knock it out. You're not happy you got to come in on weekend.
Right.
But luckily the ship isn't doing like fuel or ammo unload. So we're able to get right in, spend the whole day doing what we need to do and get a lot of work done.
It sounds like you're very dedicated to the craft. And, you know, I think that's what we need here at Marmac and what we need for the Navy. So, so on our last episode, we had some DCs on and they were curious about learning more about what the welders do in Code 921. Are there any other shops that you'd be interested in learning about here at Marmac?
Definitely the machine shop. Understand how they go through all their process, their different equipment. I've wandered through the MR side quite a few times. They help us a lot where if like we have a certain plate that say we need a plate that's an eighth inch, but we only have quarter inch and we need it done. They'll take that plate. They'll mill it down to exactly where we need it. And just overall, they help us a lot. It's definitely interesting to see how they get it done to help assist us with our job.
We'll definitely try our hardest to get the machine shop on the podcast. I think that'd be a good segment. So. Is there anything else you would like to say at all or anything?
If you want to get into welding, make sure you have dry gloves.
Dry gloves, okay. Yeah,
that's a big one, especially with the rainy seasons. As soon as those gloves get wet, be careful. You will get shocked.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
And has it happened to you?
Once, put my hand in a puddle by accident, and I went to grab the rod, put in the stinger, and because my hand was wet, connected to that rod when it was actively going in the stinger, felt a little jolt, and I was like, that didn't feel good.
There it goes. Yeah. Well, as my dad used to say, it builds character.
Yeah.
So, again, thank you so much for your time. It was very nice talking to you. We will try our hardest to get someone from the machine shop in here so we can all learn more about what they do. So again, thank you.
Thank you.
May was Mental Health Awareness Month, and June focused on PTSD awareness. But mental health matters all year long. Command Counselor Flora Papadimitriou dropped by to share a message with the Marmec team. Whatever you're facing, she wants you to know, support is here and you don't have to go it alone.
Hey Marmec family, this is Flora Papadimitriou, one of your licensed professional counselors here at Marmec. I want to take this moment to remind you that taking care of your mind is just as important as maintaining the equipment and systems you work with every day. In our high-pressure work environment, it's normal to experience stress, anxiety, or feeling overwhelmed. What's not normal is ignoring these feelings or thinking you have to handle everything alone. Your mental health directly impacts your work performance, your relationships, and your overall quality of life. Now, I know that there's still some hesitation around reaching out. You might even wonder if it makes you look weak, if others will judge or feel it impact your career. But remember, you don't have to face these challenges alone. Right here at Marmec, we have two licensed professional counselors, including myself, Laura Papadimitriou, over at CP200, and my colleague, Noelle Bice, who's located at LF18. We don't take notes, we don't report to your leadership, and we're not here to evaluate you. We're here to listen, help you make sense of what you're going through, and offer tools to support you. Not just in crisis, but in everyday stress, relationships, identity, purpose, or just figuring things out. It's important to remember, we all contribute to the culture around mental health, whether you realize it or not. Maybe it's what we think about other people with mental illness. Maybe it's how we talk to ourselves when we're struggling, or how we respond when someone else is. We might think, I'm not the right person to help, or they're just having a bad day, and then we let it pass. But this month, I challenge you, be an upstander. Normalize asking, hey, are you okay? Or normalize even saying, actually, I've been struggling too. The more we talk about mental health like we do physical health, the more we break the stigma. Remember that seeking support isn't a weakness, it's a strength. It shows you're not only taking care of yourself, but you're also staying mission ready. And when you speak up, check in on someone, or even just show up to learn more, you're not just helping yourself, but you're becoming a mental health advocate. And that matters. Remember that you are a part of this Marmec family. So take care of yourself, look out for others, and remember that asking for help is always okay. Stay strong, Marmec family.
Whether it's bumper stickers or social media posts, even small oversights can have big consequences when it comes to OPSEC. Operational security isn't just for deployments or classified environments. As Operations Security Manager Charles Miller reminds us, it's a day-to-day mindset.
I tell sailors and the civilians who's coming on board, a lot of people tend to tell on themselves all the time. My husband's on deployment pulling into this port, or my wife is coming back on this day. All of that is OPSEC.
Charles has the pleasure of reviewing all of our podcast episodes to clear them for OPSEC before they're released. So he's familiar with the show, and we're excited to have him on. We hear tips on how to stay vigilant and learn the backstory behind that mysterious purple dragon we've all seen around. So without further ado, let's check in with Oscar Pope and Charles Miller.
I'm here with the one and only, the man, the myth, the legend, Charles Miller. Charles, thanks for being here this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. Good to see you here. Tell us a little bit about yourself. So we know we're here for OPSEC. Tell us a little about your background.
All right, a little bit about myself. I was in the Navy like many people, more likely at the command. During my time on active duty, I dealt with a lot of weapons. And when I finished up my first enlistment, I decided to go to shore duty. And when I went to shore duty, I went to be an instructor, where I got into the MAA school, Center for Security Force, teaching small arms, force protection, anti-terrorism, pretty much everything, security reaction, ASF Academy, and so forth. And that's when I got into the whole thing of law enforcement. So when I got out of the military, I became a police officer. And while I was on police duty, I pretty much toured multiple bases in the area, which was Little Creek Base. I was over there at NSA off of Terminal Boulevard. I was over here down at Portsmouth, the hospital. That was my last tour as policing. But during that time, policing there, that's how I got into the whole operational security, because I was a force protection officer for so many years, policing and being an anti-terror officer. So after doing that for so long, I decided to utilize some of my other NECs, and here I am at Marmec as the operational security program manager.
Basically, this is how you came to be into the OPSEC field. Lots of experience in law enforcement.
Correct.
You said you were an MA, Master at Arms in the Navy.
I wasn't AMA. I was an AO, the best rate in the Navy, by the way.
Arguable.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to say the ordnance. You know, Arslan, if you ain't ordnance, y'all know the rest of it. But I got into actual, when I went to explore the weapon side on shore duty. That's how I got into the MA world. And I ended up falling in love with it. So that's why when I got out of the military, I became police officer. So.
Okay, yo, no judgment there. You think the AOs are the best?
Right? We are the best.
We argue that the operations specialists are still holding it down. Across the
military. Respect.
It has to be respect there. Tell us a little bit about OPSEC. Like, why is it important? Like, what do we need it for?
OPSEC, in a nutshell, is I believe, and we all should feel that it is important because, again, in law enforcement, force protection, anti-terrorism protection, I look at that like that's the entire house. And then when it comes down to OPSEC, OPSEC would be a bedroom in said house. And we must protect our house at all costs. And we do that in various ways. So take the base here. We're on Norfolk base here in Norfolk. We have multiple layers of security here. We have the MAs at the gate. We have the hack system. If somebody runs the gate, it pops up. And we have the police on patrol. They do rams around here. These are all different ways to protect us and keep us safe. And then we get here to the building, we have to scan in using our CAT cards. And if we don't have ability to scan in, we must sign in those visitors log. This is all force protection. This is all OPSEC in a sense. And this is why I think it's very important because we have plenty of things we must protect that is vital to us here at Marmac.
Absolutely. It's a lot of checkpoints, lots of screening involved. So we must make sure that we're protecting this house, like you said.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of OPSEC.
Okay.
Now, I know you didn't have anything to do with the design of this purple dragon, this mysterious purple dragon, but nonetheless, it is a figurehead for OPSEC. So tell us a little bit about the history and how OPSEC even got started.
Well, the purple dragon is the OPSEC mascot, and it came from like the Joint Chief of Staff. During Vietnam, back then, we was noticing, or the government was noticing, like a lot of our operations was being infiltrated and countered, and pretty much a lot of the soldiers were being hurt during Vietnam, but they couldn't understand why. The Joint Chief of Staff came up with a way to understand why this was happening, and they ended up calling it the Purple Dragon Initiative. During the Purple Dragon Initiative, this is when they went out there and they said, okay, I see we got spillage of critical information. This is how the Vietnam people was able to hurt our soldiers and jeopardize our mission. And so once the Joint Chief of Staff was rolling that out, and once they understood why it was important to protect critical information at all times, they used B-52 bombers called Rolling Thunders at the time to help decimate a lot of the things that was going on during the Vietnam War. This is how the Purple Dragon came about, because that was the initial name of the operation, and it just happened to stick around.
That's interesting. Yeah, I came across an article on Divots. Credit to Christy Britt. Okay. Jared, if you can pull that up on the screen, pull that article up on the screen. I'm going to read a paragraph from that article. And it says, so this effort came from early involvements in the war when several of the military operations were not successful, as it was concluded that the U.S. forces were inadvertently revealing vital information to the enemy. And military leaders consider what information could be dangerous in the hands of the adversary and how it may be collected. So with Purple Dragon in effect and helping to exploit the weaknesses in protecting information, the U.S. military was then able to remedy those weaknesses and keep knowledge contained. So that's crazy. Perfect. How we were just giving out, you know, sensitive information to the enemy unbeknownst to ourselves.
You know, quiet as a kept, people still do that to this day. A lot of times during like command doc, you know, I got to do the operational brief for NDOC. I tell sailors and the civilians who's coming on board, in this day and age of social media age, a lot of people tend to tell on themselves all the time. My husband's on deployment, pulling into this port, or my wife is coming back on this day. All of that is OPSEC. So you got to think about it. Or even if you're driving on 64 going home, you're behind somebody in traffic and you can see on their license plate they have a football team. And your mind is like, this person likes the New York Jets. I see husband, wife, kid, dog. This person has a family, him and two children, a dog. This is all OPSEC. So we have to be mindful of the things that we're portraying and putting out there, because you never know who's looking at it and could be keeping tabs on you.
That's right. What's called the aggregation of information.
Correct.
That can definitely get you in hot water.
Correct.
This brings us to this month's theme. What is this month's theme for OPSEC?
This month's theme for OPSEC is integrating OPSEC into the the mission or the command's mission, Navy's big mission, and it goes back again back to the Purple Dragon Initiative. OPSEC is extremely important, and we take it for granted because a lot of times we don't get necessarily domestic home attacks like that, but we do have homegrown terrorism, you know, here in the States, even though it's spread out. So when it comes to integrating OPSEC into our daily mission, that could just not necessarily mean here for work and be in our home lives. When you leave for work in the morning, you don't leave your windows open in your house or your front door unlocked, or if you park in a bad neighborhood, you're not leaving your purse sitting on the dashboard with the windows down.
Right.
You're taking into your mind that I must protect my vital information in my personal life, so why don't we protect our vital information at work? So for us here at Marmac, of course, we fix ships, we protect ships. We have subcodes here. We got weapon systems here. There's a bunch of different. We got the ops center. Message traffic going out constantly. So we must make sure we're integrating that always and protecting our critical information.
That's right. Yeah, we do employ OPSEC even when we don't really think about it at
home.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely not leaving valuable items in my car, especially when you're in bad areas. DONSEC has these actionable tenets. Talk to us a little bit about what those actionable tenets are.
Some of the actual tenets is protecting our critical information. Like if around the command, I typically update it yearly because, you know, as a part of the SecDev message out, I must correct it, look at it, and get it signed by the CO yearly. So the critical information, I try to always send it out to you guys on the PAO list. You know, I'll put out different security awarenesses every month. And I have them posted around the command outside the Granby room right there by the break room right there. When you come out, you'll see it in a glass case. But I try to make sure that we got our seal out. And the same thing for NDOC. I give it out to each individual person like a little screenshot, a little snippet they can put up at their desk. That's some of the things we have to protect. And once we understand what's on the seal, these are do's and don'ts. We have to make sure our vulnerabilities are always under our protection. And the way we do that is by locking up our desks at night, making sure that we don't leave any PII on the desk, making sure that if we're going to get rid of something, we're not necessarily crumbling up and throwing it in the garbage. We're going to shred it or put it in the shred bin. This is how we keep it protected. And it's something that we must always do at all times.
Let's talk about some of the must-dos. What must we as employees of Marmac, what are some of the things that we are required to do?
Some of the requirements that we have to do is, again, understand what is the information that is on our SEAL, which is our Critical Information Indicators List. If you guys have any questions on that, please just reach out to me. I'll get it to you. I'll come to your shop or I'll come to you individually and explain it to you. That's a must at all times. We have to keep that under our protection. And when it comes to things we post online, again, a lot of times I'm not going to personally look at no one's social media. People usually get caught up on social media because Seaman, you know, Smuckatelli come up to me and say, hey, I seen so-and-so post this, or take a look at this person's Facebook or that person's, you know, Instagram, then I'll do it. But we have to be mindful of the things that we're posting online. The CEO just put out, I want to say maybe 2 months ago, the new social media policy. If you haven't read it, it was sent out all hands. We can, you know, get it to you if you need it. But it's pretty much saying in a nutshell that be careful with all the political stuff that you say because it can come back and burn you. And we don't necessarily want anybody to get caught up in anything that's going to get someone caught severely and lose their job or sell or go to mass. So we must make sure that we are keeping that in mind. And again, I mentioned the shredding. Don't necessarily ball up an old eval or old credit card statements, because I've seen people put credit card statements inside these shred bins when we go through them, because we do that.
Wow.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, you'll be surprised. Shred the stuff. And don't bring your personal, you know, your PII information necessarily here to destroy it, like throwing the shred bin. Because like I said, we've at CEP 200, and I've seen it here as well, people's credit card statements in the shred bin.
So you mean to tell me I can't take an old credit card and just cut it up in multiple different ways and it'll be safe?
You can do that at your own home, but if you bring it here and someone can pick that up, or if the shred bin is full and they reach their little fingers through a little slit there and pull it out and piece it together and then possibly steal your information, then that would be on you per se. But be careful, because like I said, I've been numerous times that we checked the shred bins and we found credit cards, not even cut up real good, with people's socials, and if we were criminals and bad guys, then next, you know, hey, we could open an account in their name. So
absolutely. That definitely falls into the area of P
PII. So when somebody discovers your PII at the location where you are, they can kind of put 2-2 together. This person works at Marmag.
Correct.
And now, next thing you know, they're looking for you to exploit information from you. So it all ties together. Is that what you're
definitely
saying?
Definitely do. Scam likely. We all get the harassment text messages and phone calls. And the latest one I've been seeing is the Easy Pass ones. So I guess it's real big in this area now. That's what NCIS was telling us to be wary of, you know, when they send out information to all the OPSEC managers in the region. But yeah, if you see the tolls that comes up, hey, click this link, your toll, you know, you got a fine or we're going to get you. That's all scam.
Yep, I've seen plenty of those.
Right. So be careful. So people more than likely, what NCIS relayed to us was your information is leaked somewhere and they're just looking for the rest of it. So you click those links, they're going to infiltrate your phone because most of our phones got our credit cards on it. And fill in the information that we saved. So I always tell people, be careful with doing that because you never know when your stuff is going to get hacked or leaked out on a black market somewhere. And that's why we all get those scam likely phone calls and text messages because our information has been jeopardized somewhere.
Is it safe to say that one of us, like one of three, you, Jared, and I here, is it safe to say that at least one of us are going to get hacked in the near future?
It's possible. It's possible. So again, I'm real big on double verifications on all accounts. For me personally, I put all my credit cards and my checking account information and anything more than $4.99, it alerts me and it asks me to validate it. You know,
$4.99.
I swear to God, I will show you. I swear it's that low because I'm afraid of someone, you know, messing with my money. I work hard for my money. That's I got a family, so I don't want to go backwards in life. I work hard to go forward. I use stuff as simple as low. I put it on the lowest setting, which is like $4.99 or $5 or something. And it literally, if I'm at 7-Eleven, if I swipe something for $7, my phone will go off and tell me.
I never thought about that. I might lower my limit as well.
Yeah, it could help, brother.
Nice, nice. Hey, talk to us about reporting. How do we report suspected OPSEC to you?
All right. So in any time you think that something is wrong, I actually get a lot of emails or phone calls about this. The main one I'm seeing lately, because we work in security, our security section, the personal security side of the house, they initiate your background investigation. So it sends an email link out to personnel to command. And people call me all the time. Hey, is this legit? I'd never seen this before. What is going on? And I have to confirm with them like, hey, yes, this is the system automatically generated because you're in your window for your security clearance. And it's trying to get your background investigation started. So if it's something like that, just keep in mind, call us in the front. We'll take care of you. But if you need to report something that you think suspicious, it's something as simple as that. Pick the phone up, email us, and I'll come to you or send me what you got, and we'll look into it. If it's legit, it's legit. If I have to report it to my counterparts in CIS or base security, we'll take care of it from there. But the main thing is letting us know so we can do our due diligence to protect information or protect you and your family and your assets.
Thank you. It's all about responsibility to maintain OPSEC. You heard the saying, loose lips sank ships.
That's true.
Such a true statement. Charles, such a pleasure to have you here. My brother from another mother.
Yes, sir.
Hey, man, if you're out there listening, we want to leave you with a final thought. So we each have a duty to know, conceal, and protect critical information. OPSEC is a shared responsibility and is essential to mission success and national security. So let's ensure these principles are acknowledged and actively implemented across all levels. Thanks again, Charles.
Thanks for having me.
From operational security to operational excellence, let's talk about Carl Bush. Earlier this year, Carl received the Commander's Innovation Award at the NAVC Excellence Awards. He's modest about his work, but the recognition is well-deserved. Marmac Commanding Officer Captain Heminger met with Carl to offer his congratulations, and we had a chance to hear more about the effort that earned Carl the spotlight. Let's take a listen.
Basically, it was creating schematics to enable me to troubleshoot cards that were no longer being supported by the manufacturer, original equipment manufacturer. Basically, out of necessity more than desire, but just to keep things rolling and keep the systems up and operational.
So Carl's being modest. So I will say across the NAVC enterprise, Carl was awarded the Commander's Innovation Award. So that's across the NAVC enterprise. Over 80,000 people, right? So what Carl did was he solved a critical issue that was impacting surface readiness, right?
So we couldn't get the part. Carl reverse engineered the circuit cards, and I mean, he epitomizes what it means to be an engineer for an RMC. So we're very proud of him, and we're happy to have him.
Congratulations again, Carl. Your story is a great example of how one person's dedication can drive meaningful change. And while we're on the topic of recognition, I'd like to give a quick shout out to the rest of the Marmac Public Affairs Office, including Doug Denzine, who led our team before passing the torch to Chris Wyatt. Our office was honored to receive the Team Award for Excellence in Public Affairs at the NAFC Excellence Awards this year, and we're proud to continue our mission of sharing the incredible work happening around the command. Thank you, and well done, team. Imagine a magic box that could create almost any part you need on demand. It might sound like science fiction, but with additive manufacturing, it's quickly becoming a reality. For the final segment on today's episode, Harrison sat down with Trevor Poole of the Command Innovation Lab to talk about how 3D printing is already reshaping logistics at Marmac, reviving hard-to-source parts, shortening repair timelines, and opening up new possibilities for how we support the fleet.
Okay, hello everyone. I am here with Trevor Poole. Trevor, how are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm very good. So, Trevor, what do you do here at Marmac?
So, I run the Innovation Lab. So, we do all of Marmac's advanced manufacturing to include additive manufacturing, any sort of laser cutting, or really anything where there's a computer in the loop to help us get a final product.
Okay, well, it sounds like a very important job. So, Trevor, how did you get into this line of work?
So I got into this during college. So I actually did the cooperative plan at Georgia Tech, where we worked with outside companies. In this case, it was kind of a pseudo outside company with the Georgia Tech Research Institute. And they do prototype military hardware, you know, novel things that haven't been done before. So I kind of learned to specialize in the new and unfamiliar, if you will, and those skills kind of transitioned here to Marmac with the advanced and additive manufacturing, solving those unique problems that maybe we haven't come across yet.
So Georgia Tech, so are you from Georgia?
I am from Atlanta.
Okay, very nice. Okay, so you mentioned additive manufacturing. What exactly is that? Is that the 3D printing?
Yeah, so additive manufacturing is more commonly known as 3D printing. So in traditional manufacturing, you take a block of metal and use a cutting tool to remove material. So that's, you know, subtractive manufacturing, whereas additive, we're depositing either plastic or metal.
Okay, so I know here at Marmac, we do 3D printing, and we do have a very large machine to do it, and it's called the DMG Mooring Machine. Is that correct?
So the company is DMG Mori. It's a LaserTech 65 hybrid. At its heart, it's a five-axis CNC. So the five-axis in traditional milling, most people are familiar with, it's got an X, Y, and Z. This one also has an A and a C axis, which means that the table can flip up and also rotate. So when we're making a part, we can get around it at different angles and do more complex things that, you know, traditionally couldn't be done on a three-axis, or it makes it a lot simpler.
And what kind of things are you making with that machine?
So the machine's very new to Marmac, so we're still experimenting with its capabilities. So far, we've done a few small metal 3D prints on it. We've done a lot more traditional manufacturing, where we're just putting in a piece of material and subtracting it and milling it out. But we're doing it a lot easier and faster just because the five-axis capabilities give us that freedom. We've also conducted our first additive repair. That's one of the unique capabilities about this machine, is that instead of building a part from scratch like you would in plastic, we can load in a damaged part, machine out the damaged area, and then refill that metal and then remachine it all in one build to the final dimensions.
If 3D printing wasn't an option, how long would that process take?
In some cases, we wouldn't be able to do the repair. There are some weld repair options we could do, but you know, you'd have to have a machinist machine it out, take it out, take it to a welder, have them fill it, and then re-put it up on a machine. And all that setup takes a lot of time. So you can do this in one setup in this machine, which we can make parts faster. In some cases, if we couldn't, you know, do the repair any other way, you know, you'd have to buy a whole new part or assembly. So that's one of the ways that this can really save the Navy a lot of money. So our first trial additive repair, we repaired a motor flange that had gotten gouged out. We did the process, as I described before, machining out the damage, filling it, remachining it. So that top motor flange, you can't just buy. You can't get it from the stock system. You have to buy the entire motor. Mm. And so the entire motor is about $115,000. They're a long lead time item. There's currently only two in the stock system.
Oh, man.
But with about $50 in powder, we've now repaired this and are looking to get it approved.
That's honestly really cool. What are some things that you normally make with a 3D printing machine?
So a lot of our parts that we do in plastic, there's currently a NAVC catalog of approved parts that any ship can print freely and install, no DFS required. So we do a lot of those type of parts supporting ships. It can be anything from overboard discharge scuppers for corrosion control, knobs, switches, handles, things that you can't just buy the piece. You end up having to buy the whole assembly for way too much money. Mm-hmm. We also do a lot supporting the STEM program here at Marmec. So they go out to schools, air shows, demonstrate the technology that we have here at Marmec. So they take along some of their 3D printers, and we help support them by either designing and building pieces for them, or in the case of an air show, we're a little bit of overflow capacity for them in case they need to crank out 500 chips or something to hand out to kids.
Oh, cool. It definitely makes me jealous, because when I was a kid, there was none of that. Like, 3D printing was not a thing. So, I'm sure the kids really do love that. So what would you say is the most challenging project that you've had to work on?
I'd say the most challenging project is the dive we're doing now into metal 3D printing. Mm. Because with polymer 3D printing, it's fairly well understood. You've gotten certain temperatures, certain ways to design it. But metal is so very new, and there's a variety of technologies out there. So with plastic 3D printing, it's essentially a hot glue gun on a CNC, just moving around, melting plastic, putting it down. With metal printing, you've got different types, either powder or wire metal based. And then depending on the technology, you start getting into the metallurgy, the heat treatment, and there's just, a whole order of magnitude more factors to consider when you're making a part. So it's definitely one of the bigger challenges we're working through, but it's the future of manufacturing. So we're going to get it and get it right.
Metal 3D printing is still cost effective, correct? Versus like regular maintenance?
In some cases. So typically, if you're doing like a powdered metal, the powdered metal can be more expensive than raw stock, so you have to factor in how much material you'd be removing versus building it up for the cost effectiveness there. In some cases, the metal 3D printing is a more viable option anyway, because it's a way to manufacture parts that we can't currently do. So casting has kind of been declining in the United States, so mm-hmm. being able to make these cast parts, a lot of components on ships are actually cast metals. So you've got valve bodies, things like that. So being able to manufacture them using additive gives us an alternative versus having to go out and get it casted, and we can typically do it a lot faster. So if you're worried about things like timelines, ship schedules, getting that CAS rep fixed, additive is definitely a great tool in the toolbox.
So you mentioned that there are 3D printers being installed on ships for them to be able to repair their own equipment. Could you just talk to me a little bit about how that's going and what that entails?
Sure. So we work very closely with the AM Afloat team. So they're actually doing the physical installs on the ship. Through our lab at Marmec, we're helping provide training to the sailors so they know how to use the software, how to operate the printers, and do maintenance. Currently, I believe there's a plan to get just about every ship a 3D printer by 2030.
Okay.
So the small boys like the DDGs and the subs, they're probably going to be polymer only. But the big decks, your carriers, your LHAs, they're getting metal hybrid capability as well.
Oh, man.
Yep. So this will allow sailors, if they're out at sea, they'll be able to make and print their own parts for repair or that temporary solution to get them home. Yeah. So AM allows the sailors to organically repair those pieces, parts at sea.
I know it depends on the part or the processing time. What is like the average processing time to create a part that's needed?
So if we're looking at the polymer side of the house, typically the parts usually are about the size of your fist. So if the model already exists, it can be on average about a 6-hour print time. So if the ship's got the material, they've got the file, it's almost as easy as file print, and they've got a solution in under a day.
Wow.
If they have to do a little bit of reverse engineering, a little bit of modeling, typically that'll depend on the skill of the operator, how fast that goes, but it's still much faster than getting FedEx out to the boat or something.
Right, correct. What do you find most rewarding about your work?
I'd say the most rewarding part is the problem solving, because there's, you know, these issues out there that if we're looking at additive to solve it, it's usually something that can't be done traditionally or where there's a problem somewhere else, whether it's there's not enough in the stock system or they need it faster or it's just completely obsolete and we have to make it because nobody else can. Being able to use these tools and come up with a solution that helps get that ship underway is extremely satisfying.
Talking about collaboration, are there any other shops that you or your shop collaborate with?
Oh, we work extensively with almost everybody. So in the realm of advanced manufacturing, we're currently embedded with the Inside Machine, so we'll utilize some of their CNCs. You know, we'll work with the weld branch for anything that needs to be welded or water jetted. And then really, we don't have a unique system that we work on. We kind of touch a little bit of everything. So I'll get calls from various engineering codes, you know, with, hey, here's my problem. I kind of have an idea of how I want it solved and we'll take a look at it and then pass our solution on to them. That way they can use it. They've got the technical understanding of the system to make sure that it'll perform properly.
What would you tell someone who is thinking about getting in this field of work?
I'd say to try it at home. There's a lot of low-cost, consumer-grade 3D printers you can get online for just a few $100. The plastic's typically very cheap. And then there's whole repositories online of free models that you can print and try out, whether it's, you know, little trinkety keychains or something, or even tools for home improvement. So it's a good starting place to kind of see the technology, understand how it works, and from there you can grow with getting CAD software so you can design your own parts, learning how to slice them and get them to your 3D printer, and it's kind of a constant evolution of learning.
Is there anyone else that you would maybe want to hear on the podcast? Any other shops? Or
I mean, I love hearing about all the shops that we have here at Marmec, because there's always some unique perspective, some system. Like, as an engineer, I'm always interested in how stuff works. So, you know, any detail on what they do in their systems and, you know, maybe how I can help them.
For sure. Yeah. Where do you see the 3D printing technology going in the future for the Navy?
I think in the future, the additive manufacturing and the hybrid manufacturing are almost going to become the standard. Mm. You know, it's probably not going to be in the next few years, but as we better understand the metallurgy, how we make these parts, you know, being able to turn a spool of wire into any component you need has tremendous advantages, you know, as far as supply goes. That way you don't have to, a ship doesn't have to carry, you know, 50 different sizes of stock. You know, you're using less material to make the same part, so it's less to carry on board. It's really has a lot of efficiencies there. So I see the Navy moving towards a lot more metal 3D printing, just in various forms, because there are different styles of metal printing that each have their advantages and disadvantages, and just being able to exploit the advantages of each one.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, time and the availability of resources is such an issue right now for the Navy. I'm sure having control of that is a huge advantage for us. So, Trevor, where can we find you here at Marmec?
Sure. So I'm located over at CEP 200 in room 55. That's on Main Street right next to the ATM.
Well, Trevor, thank you again for coming in. This was an awesome segment, and I definitely learned a lot about 3D printing and everything. So thank you.
Thank you. Happy to share.
And that is a wrap on another episode of the Maintainer Podcast. As always, thank you to the teams across Marmec who helped bring these stories to life. And thank you for tuning in. More conversations and command highlights are headed your way soon. Before we go, I'll hand it off to a few of our shipmates to help close us out.
This is Lieutenant Link.
This is ITN1 Sinclair.
This is Paul Broxton, Advanced Planning Manager. The Maintainer Podcast is produced
by the Marmec Public Affairs Office.
Follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn by searching
Mid-Atlantic Regional Maintenance Center.
You can also check out the Marmac News and Event page on SharePoint
to stay current with everything happening around the command.
If you have an idea for a future episode,
or if your team is doing something that command needs to hear about,
drop us a line at Public Affairs.
We'd love to hear from you.
We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, fair winds and following seas. I'm Jared Patch, and you've been listening to The Maintainer Podcast. Over and out.
I'm cool with it because when I got the headphones on, nobody bothers me.
That's right. You in your space.
Yeah. They like, oh, he's in the meeting. I'm like, Meanwhile, I'm listening to Jared in the interviews. Yeah. Click, 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 click.